Take a breath, lift your head, and admire. Everywhere you look, stocks are going higher. It's an uptrend, friend. We've been seeing them more often. Even when the economy starts to soften, but low rates and another spending bill could push valuations up over the hill. If inflation ever comes, this could be a real mess. So we'll just ride low on the Investopedia Express. Welcome aboard, riders. U.S. equity markets are coming off their best week since early November, with the S&P 500, the NASDAQ, and the Russell 2000 all at record highs. Oil prices are at a one-year high, and the yields on long-term U.S. government treasuries are also at or nearing their pre-pandemic highs. Corn futures also at multi-year highs. You'll feel that in your Cheerios if you haven't already. Asset prices are on the rise. That's all there is to it. Even gasoline is getting more expensive. For those on the top of the K-shaped recovery, rising asset prices have been a boon to their bottom lines. Their homes are worth more. Their portfolios are worth more. And a little inflation never bothered them anyway. For those at the bottom or those who fell through the cracks during the pandemic, rising asset prices amid an economic recovery they're not participating in is debilitating. The U.S. reported the addition of less than 50,000 jobs last month in another sign of the dislocation of the labor market. 10 million people are still out of work, 11 months since the pandemic was declared. The Biden administration says more fiscal stimulus can put people back to work and prevent more Americans from falling into poverty. Speaking of poverty, income inequality has been with us long before this pandemic, and it will be with us long after. But how do we address it in a meaningful way without just paying lip service? For us, it's about education, but making sure that education is reaching the people who need it most. Coming up on The Express, Tyrone Ross Jr. climbs aboard and he'll share a very special project he's working on to address income inequality through education in public schools. You'll want to stay tuned for that. But first, let's get set up for the week ahead. It's another busy week in corporate earnings as we'll get results from companies including Cisco Systems, Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, Disney, and General Motors, among others. GM shocked the auto world a couple of weeks ago when it said it will be fully electric by 2035. Ford came back last week and increased the amount it will invest in its electric future by $29 billion over the next 2 years. The more automakers say the word electric, the higher their stock prices seem to go. Shares of Detroit's finest, GM and Ford, are both up 30% since the beginning of the year. As the market marches on to new record highs, so has the concentration of the market caps of the companies leading the indexes. While it's true that more stocks are in uptrends, the big keep getting bigger and their P/E ratios are getting swollen again. According to J.P. Morgan Asset Management, the weight of the top 10 stocks in the S&P 500 is just under 30%. Near record highs. The top 10 stocks, and you know who they are, have an average P/E ratio of 32.2 versus 19.1 for the remaining stocks in the index, and they contributed 25.6% of the S&P 500's overall earnings over the last 12 months. The FANGMA stocks, that's Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Alphabet, which is Google, and Microsoft, saw their market caps swell from nearly $5 trillion at the end of 2019 to $7.5 trillion at the end of 2020. That's trillion with a T. The K-shaped recovery is even more extreme inside the balance sheets of our public companies. This lack of balance wasn't a problem in 2020 amid the recovery, and every time the FANGMA stocks sell off, investors are more than willing to buy the dip, at least for now. It's getting kind of steep out there in yield curve country. Long-term treasury yields climbed higher in the past week and are headed that way to start this week on more investor confidence in the economic recovery. The spread between the yield on the 2-year treasury note and the 10-year treasury note widened to more than 1% last week. So watch the gap this week, especially given the prospects for the passage of the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan. More spending means more economic growth, which is why those bond yields are getting steeper. With the January jobs report last week showing a continually sluggish labor market, President Biden and congressional Democrats are planning to push the bill through without House approval by passing a budget resolution last week and putting the bill forward through the budget reconciliation process that basically allows them to skirt the Senate's filibuster. They are looking to pass the package in the next 2 weeks. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said the passage would help the U.S. economy get back to full employment next year. 4% unemployment is usually considered the government's benchmark for full employment. In an interview that aired right before the Sunday Super Bowl, President Biden urged the passage of the bill yet again, but said the $15 per hour minimum wage he promised during his campaign will likely not make it into this bill. Democrats are also expected to introduce a $3,000 per child tax credit to attach to the $1.9 trillion rescue plan. The bill would provide families with $3,600 per child under 6 years old and $3,000 per child between 6 and 17 years of age, with the amount beginning to decline for families earning $150,000 per year and individuals earning $75,000 per year. Everyone agrees that we need financial literacy. Most people will agree that we should start teaching it to kids at a younger and younger age. Most people will also agree that we should be teaching it to low-income communities, to the people who need it most, but get it the least. I agree with all these things. A lot of people are talking about doing something about these issues, but not a lot of people are actually doing anything. Tyrone Ross Jr. is not one of those people. He's made financial literacy his life's mission, his passion, and his legacy. And he's with us today on The Express. Welcome, my friend.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a blessing to be here.
You have your fingers in so many pies, Tyrone, that we call you the baker around here. But let's start with one that's front and center and one that I have the privilege of being involved with. That's Learn to Money. Tell our listeners what Learn to Money is, why you're doing it, and why it's so important to you and the communities like the one you grew up in.
You know, having been, you know, in financial services for the last, 13 years, and then the previous six, right, 19 years total, traveling around the country, going into schools and just looking at the disconnect between those that are money fluent and those that aren't, and growing up in a household that was completely void of any type of financial literacy or financial education, and growing up not speaking the language of money in a capitalist society. Last year, I just had enough. I'd been on committees, I had done all types of things, and it was just like, we need to get into the soil. The seeds are cheap. The soil is expensive. And we need to get into the soil, and the soil are our kids. And I was just like, you know what? I want to tweet this out and see what the response is. And a half hour later, I get an email from Eric, who we work with. And Eric was like, are you really serious about doing this idea of changing financial media? And I'm like, yeah, it didn't have a name at the time. I just knew I wanted to do it. And I felt like if we are finally going to have this make sense, we got to go younger, right? Kids can start picking up financial concepts at three. Let's make it engaging. Let's make it fun and finally do something to, again, put our fingers in the soil and not just throw seeds over the fence. So that's what Learn to Money is. It evolved into something that I had never imagined with a tweet, but was blessed to have you involved, Investopedia involved, so many others, so many people who donated to this cause. And I think what we've seen, one, with the trailer, two, with the GoFundMe raising, you know, we're talking now a day after the pilot went out, that there is a need for this. People know it's a need. People are fired up for it. Sometimes you just need people to go first. And I'm glad we went first. And now we got a whole army of people who want to support us. So it's awesome to see.
Yeah, I saw your tweet. Then I saw the trailer that you and Eric and Andrew put together, our production partners on this, which was just simple and elegant. And I called you immediately. I was like, whatever I can do, I will lean into this completely. And folks, we put up the Learn to Money trailer on our Twitter and Instagram pages. So check that out. Plus follow Tyrone and you can see exactly what we're talking about. And learntomoney.org. We're talking about a digital video series, really. A video series, it doesn't have to be just digital, that's educational, that teaches kids the basics of money, but is also part of an educational curriculum that we would like to get into school. So if we could manifest this, or if you could manifest this how awesome it could be, what does it look like to you in a couple of years?
What it looks like to me is this: we force the hand that finally makes our government say all 50 states need this in school. That's one. I want to get it in schools, but we finally need to have some type of legislation where all 50 states require it. And I think Learn to Money would be a really cool way to say, hey, we'll give you the content. We'll make it easy for you. Every state should require this. I think the other thing is, some way, somehow, I personally want to go to every single state in this country and to the poorest areas and speak to children, speak to communities, speak to schools, and let them know that, one, I am committed to getting in front of these children, staying committed to them, and using allies like yourself and all of our friends with a lot of connections, networks, money, all of that stuff, and that we are going to continue to be a resource to leave a legacy of financial education in America. The last thing is exactly that. When I take my last breath, It should be, you know what? He changed the course of financial education in this country. And I am dumb enough to wake up every day and believe that I'm going to do it. But with folks like you, I don't think it would be as hard, as daunting as I think.
You have been pounding on this table long before it was sort of a popular issue. I used to met you at some conferences back when we used to go to financial industry conferences where it's all big money. It's all big investment players, all financial services. We're talking about creating products for the invested, for the wealthy. And I remember you saying this 5 miles from where we're having shrimp cocktail and talking about the next great ETF. They can't afford to put lunch on the table in a public school. And that drives you crazy, and it's driving me crazy. And I think you've probably, you know, woken a lot of people up just by being so passionate about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Grateful for the conversation that we had. And again, like as I told you, it was surreal to sit down with you, because Investopedia was so important to me as growing up in a home that didn't have that education. And I walked onto Wall Street. I still don't know how I got the job, but I had to get up to speed. And you guys were one of the resources that helped me get up to speed, truly. So just imagine that. If it's not for you, before you even met me, you created me. And that's what I'm trying to get people to understand. If you guys like me so much, there's a million more kids like me. Help me go get them into this business. Now we have a million Tyrones, right? And boys and girls in this business that can help change the world. But, you know, it's good that people want to lock arms on the mission.
Yeah. And there is a difference too. It's got to be said that learning from you is a little different than maybe learning from me. They're used to seeing white guys like me calling it what it is, out on financial media, talking about it, speaking at conferences. But it's very different when the messenger is somebody that they can relate to a little bit more. Not saying I can't do it, but there is something different about it. And you're very effective about that.
Yeah, of course. And yes, and there's nothing wrong with that, because one of the things that they tell you when you walk into a wirehouse or whatever, go get around rich people or go around the people who have it. And you start to realize a lot of those people homogeneous, right? They look the same. So there's nothing wrong with that. Groups actually, you know, tend to flock in groups, and people who look, walk, talk, and act like them. And the bottom line is sometimes the messenger is the message. Some, you walk into a room, you'll have more credibility than me. But if I walk in a room with you, I immediately have the credibility that you have, and vice versa. So I'm going to walk in rooms and get a little bit more credibility than you. But the bottom line is that's not an excuse for anybody to go. Right. And I do think, yeah, the messenger matters here. And if I don't get any other response from the pilot we just put out, the trailer, Human Advisor podcast, everything, people are like, man, to hear a different name, a different voice, a different tone, it just makes it more engaging. So that's something we need to do as a community and as a country. We need more faces, more different people doing this type of stuff.
It's great for financial literacy. It's also good for the industry that you kind of came up in, which is the financial advice industry. You're an advisor. You're now the CEO of a company. I want to get to that in a second. But you had an unlikely journey into financial services to now becoming the CEO of OnRamp Invest. Give us briefly your journey when you came out of high school. Were you even thinking about this industry? How did you wind up here?
Yeah, I wasn't really aware of Wall Street until I was 26 years old, right? I had a professor in graduate school kind of mention it. I'm like, I really don't know what you're talking about. He said, oh, you'd be great on Wall Street. I'm like, well, tell me what it is. I don't know what you're talking about. And then I always tell the story about walking right by the New York Stock Exchange and not knowing what it was. So this was not on my radar. I didn't want to be an advisor. My first Wall Street job prior to that, I was a juvenile probation officer, right? And people want to know why I'm so passionate about social justice in the community, because I had been a youth worker. I had been in an outpatient program for convicted felons getting out and juvenile issues and things like that. So I've been doing this since my early 20s. And what happened was, it's just funny how nothing in your life is wasted. So now with that background and the Wall Street background and then the advisor background, and then now as a CEO, you can pull all those things together and affect meaningful change. So that route that I took here was circuitous. I was at a brokerage house and was doing 600 dials a day. And then I was at a wirehouse. And then I learned what financial planning was and being what a real advisor was. I didn't know. Thankful to a mentor there. So I've been mentored all along the way and exposed, right? I talk about my three E's: exposure, education, and empowerment. I had to get exposed coming from a home as a first high school graduate. I had to get exposed to all of these things that everyone knew. It was just like, as a matter of fact, and I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about. I don't know what any of those things are that you're talking about. Stocks, bonds, all these mutual funds. I had no idea. So I had to as rare as the case where you are financially illiterate and you get to learn on Wall Street. And I think that's the one thing I don't tell people enough that I try and get across. I was financially illiterate and walked into the place where everybody's money fluent and you have access to all of this stuff. It was hard, but it accelerated my learning. And then it was also easy for me to see the chasm between where I come from and where I am. And I'm like, they have no desire to fill that gap. I have to the people that come from where I come from.
There was no path. You found your way there, but there's no direct paths, which
is no direct path at all,
which is why what you're doing is so important. But also some of the groups that you and I are familiar and also do some work with, like Wall Street Brown and others, they are trying to show people the path, and finding people who've gone through that path is so important. So let's talk about your other day jobs. You have several, but you're the CEO of OnRamp Invest, which calls itself a digital native investment platform for next generation advisors. When you say digital, you mean cryptocurrencies and other digital assets, right?
Yep, primarily Bitcoin to start with. When we launch, it will be Bitcoin only. Keep it very simple. We want to be the Plaid of crypto. We want to be integrated in advisors' workflow. They don't even know OnRamp is there, but it'll give them the ability to interact with Bitcoin the same way they do with Apple. So they can model, plan, build, do all the things inside of their portfolio management systems, financial planning software. It'll all pull in. You can do everything you need to do on the front end. And then on the back end, what we're going to do is provide advisors data research and everything, but also choice of qualified crypto custodian, right? So they can go directly to them and not have to leave their workflow and use, you know, everything else that's out there currently.
Platform, data, educational content. Do you think the financial advice industry is ready for cryptocurrency or Bitcoin specifically? But do you think it's ready? They're ready to accept that?
I think so. As I start to have more conversations with CIOs now, before it was just advisors. Now it's the advisors that are CIOs wanting to reach out. I had one yesterday, really large RIA. They're like, get us up to speed on this. Like, is it digital gold? Is it right? What should we be looking at? So yes, and there's a process for advisors to get in. And there's a lot more when you're a retail facing fiduciary that you have to be concerned with. But the education is one, narrative is two, right? How do we relate it to clients and to ourselves? Because you can't just say, oh, it's internet money. Well, what does that mean for my portfolio? Digital gold makes a little bit more sense. Then also credible investment thesis. I think for advisors right now, it's easy to build a credible investment thesis for Bitcoin right now, as opposed to anything else, even though the future of our business is being built on Ethereum. Advisors will find that out later. And then I think lastly is just the ability for a client to tell an advisor, well, show me. So you can model it in a portfolio, put that in front of the client and then go, oh, okay, if we put the Bitcoin in at 5%, this is what's going to happen over there, right? And then the client go, all right, do it. And then the advisor goes, all right, click, 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 boom, done. And when that happens, I think that ease of use in all things are why, you know, advisors right now are hesitant because it's not there, but the infrastructure is being built to be able to do that. And again, I think that's proof positive why advisors want an ETF. It takes a lot of that other stuff away because it's just there. It's a ticker, right? It's easy. They'll get research and all, and it's set it and forget it. So, but yeah, I do think they're ready. And I just think, of course, in this business, regulatory compliance, all that stuff should give you pause. But I'll button up by saying this. Most advisors shouldn't be doing anything. They just should be learning, preparing your practice, right? You know, updating your ADV, making sure that you are preparing your practice for the conversation. The allocation could come later, but just make sure you don't get cooked when the SEC comes knocking and saying, all right, this, that, and the third. So
we do a weekly giveaway of socks here, Tyrone, with our listeners when they ask for the term of the week. And if we choose it, we send them some Investopedia socks. You're a proud owner of those socks, but we're stepping up our game to make it a hoodie giveaway this week. We're going next level. And we asked our listeners, oh, you're definitely getting one. We asked our listeners to submit questions to me or my guest for a question they wanted answered on the podcast. Throwing at this at you, Tyrone, because I actually don't know it well enough to answer it. And my opinion matters not at all. But Tushar Mittal asks, what are some thoughts on Litecoin and Dogecoin? And what do you think about crypto ETFs? So let's start with Litecoin and Dogecoin. Do you have any opinion on those or how people should think about them?
So what a lot of people don't realize is that Litecoin is the second oldest crypto, right? So that just fun fact there. Don't have really any opinions on it. I don't pay attention to Litecoin, Dogecoin either. I think those are going to be forgotten about. I don't think they have too much use case outside of speculation. But nothing besides that, I've never taken either one seriously. I know folks are starting to pay a little bit more attention to Litecoin. I get it. But it's a great opportunity to plug crypto assets to book, because what you learn in crypto assets is all coins after Bitcoin are in some way a derivative or inspired by the Bitcoin blockchain, Litecoin, you know, Ether and everything else from that.
And there's a reason that one of our most popular articles on Investopedia, day in, day out, I don't care what's happening in the world, is what are the other cryptocurrencies besides Bitcoin? And you can learn that there as well. But good book and a good one for people to think about. And on the back end there, crypto ETFs, we know they're coming. What are your thoughts? How big do you think that'll be?
It'll be big. I'm not a fan. I've gone on record saying I hate the idea of a Bitcoin ETF. I am going to have a public rant on Twitter when one gets approved. So tune in for that. It's equivalent to putting training wheels on a Ferrari. Like, why would you do that? You're going to take 20th century infrastructure and put something that's beautiful with all of these characteristics to it in the 21st century, put those together, right? And then hand them to people. I just don't agree with it for a lot of reasons. Matt Hogan and the ETF mafia, we've been going at it for a while, but I think a Bitcoin ETF is just, it's goofy. I don't understand the point of it, but we're going to get it because people are going to make a lot of money. And I've resigned to that fact. Yeah, and it doesn't help the unbanked if it's in an ETF, which is the number one use case for Bitcoin, right? But again, it's like they don't care about the unbanked. They care about folks who are going to buy it and sell it to clients. So that's another reason why I'm anti-Bitcoin ETF.
Right. Let's circle back to the unbanked thing, because that's another passion point for you. And as we close out here, this is another one of your big issues. And one of your big passions is the fact that there are so many unbanked people in this country still. And those unbanked people come from the communities where you grew up, where being unbanked doesn't just mean you don't have a bank account and can't go to the ATM. It is the key to opening up so many different paths to growing your wealth and investing and protecting yourself. Why is it so important, Tyrone?
Exactly what you said. If I don't have a bank account, I'm just shut off from all types of commerce. I can't do anything. How do I get an apartment? How do I get a house? How do I get a car? How do I get a phone? All of these things. So let me start by saying, I believe now truly the term unbanked is doing those folks a disservice. It's underserved overall. And I want to stop using that term, because I've started to realize that there's a negative connotation that comes with it. And it doesn't really give the full extent of the problem. So I'm just going to say underserved from now on. But being unbanked is part of that. And I grew up in an unbanked home. But one of the things that you start to realize is that you pay for access. And you pay a lot of money for access, just to simply access your money now. I need it now. I need to eat now. Rent is due now. The car payment's due now, because you're just playing catch up. So if I have to go through this labyrinth of financial infrastructure to get access to my money 3 to 6 days later, we don't have a real-time payment system in this country. Egregious, right? The government says we'll get it in 3 to 4 years. So even if that's the case, and now even with stimulus, imagine if these folks have bank accounts, that money goes right into their accounts. So, you know, post office banking, all of these things where there's just our current infrastructure is not set up for people that are underserved, which is part of being unbanked. So I think as now, I personally need to stop using that, and this term evolves and make it a little bit more respective of what my parents went through. And it was my parents, by the way, that kind of brought that up. And my mother was kind of like, that's the wrong term to use, right? That was just one of our problems, right? And I was like, man, I really need to change my lens on this. So I'm going to stop saying that, but it's just underserved overall, because if you don't have a bank account, you can't do squat. And there are millions of people in this country that still live that way.
I know it is a bit, and your mom is right to have checked you on that. And I think you're absolutely right. It is just part of the problem, but there are so many problems to address. And you're leaning into it so hard. And it's such an honor to work with you and to have become friends with you in the last couple of years. Folks can follow you on Twitter. You're very prolific there. You're all over the social media platforms. You got a terrific podcast, but also just following up with learntomoney.org and this project that you're on is a great thing for people to pay attention to. And it is just an honor to have you on the Express, Tyrone. Thanks so much.
Thank you again for having me. And I'll leave with these two things. Thank you so much for being you and being a thoughtful giver and lending your microphone to me screaming for the voiceless children all over this country. And lastly, if you guys made it this far and care at all, please go to nokidhungry.org and feed a hungry child. I appreciate you.
It's terminology time. Time for the educated investor to smarten up with the investing term we need to know this week. We already did the hoodie giveaway for the week, but we'll throw a bonus term out there because it doesn't hurt to get smarter. This week's term comes right off the most popular search terms on Investopedia. With over 22 million visitors a month, we have a pretty good window as to what you're looking for. This week's term has been one of the most popular all month, and I wonder why. It's short-term capital gains, and short-term capital gains, according to Investopedia, is a profit realized from the sale, transfer, or other disposition of personal or investment property, known as a capital asset, that has been held for 1 year or less. A short-term capital gain occurs when an investment is sold that's been held for less than 1 year, such as a stock. These gains are taxed as ordinary income at the taxpayer's top marginal tax rate. So, if you sold stock you've held for less than a year, or if you're trading in and out of the market and booking gains, don't forget, those gains can be taxed as high as 37% if your income is high. You can also offset those taxes with losses. Just keep track of what you're doing. We'll let the recently departed and legendary civil rights activist and Senator John Lewis take us out this week in honor of Black History Month. Here's Senator Lewis in 2015 celebrating the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday in Selma, Alabama, which ultimately led to the March on Selma, a key moment in the battle for civil rights in America.
We must use this moment to recommit ourselves, to do all we can to finish the work. There's still work left to be done. Get out there and push and pull until we redeem the soul of America.
There is so much work still to be done. Our special thanks to Tyrone Ross Jr. for joining the show today. And don't forget to check out learntomoney.org to learn more about the financial literacy project we're working on. Thanks for riding with us this week. And until we meet again, just a little further on down the line.